It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump held a meeting on the opioid crisis that has gripped communities throughout the country. We'll talk about the federal response and take a closer look at what's happening here in Wisconsin.
First, North Korea and nuclear strikes are one of the many concerns in Washington right now. President Donald Trump issued a stern warning to North Korea for threats to the United States, speaking yesterday.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
And in the Senate, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell suggested that the president doesn't understand how Congress and the legislative process work.
Sahil Kapoor is a national political reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us to give us the latest on that and more in our Week in Washington segment. Sahil, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, this fire and fury statement from the president seems to be a lot of what's being talked about in Washington and around the world, for that matter. What are some of the reactions you're hearing in Washington, D.C.?
It is definitely the single biggest point of discussion today, and really yesterday, I think, since it happened. The really remarkable thing, I would say, that I think has caught people today is that the White House seems to be walking this back a little bit. The White House officials telling the New York Times and I think some other outlets that the president was improvising. The president's fire and fury, quote, was not vetted through his advisors and his generals and so forth, and that the White House is essentially switching the red line from rhetorical threats of action will be met with a response, a fire and fury from the United States, versus actions by North Korea are what will be met with response. So I think the White House is doing a little cleanup on the quote, because it certainly, the imagery the president used certainly evoked the horrifying specter of a nuclear war between the United States and North Korea. I think the White House wants to calm the waters a little bit on that.
And there's a recent tweet just over the last day from the president talking about the readiness of the American nuclear arsenal. Are people reading that as part of a package with the fire and fury remark?
Yes, that seemed to be, at least on the same level as that kind of escalation. When you have the president of the United States right after issuing that threat to North Korea talking about the power of the United States nuclear arsenal, I think it's pretty unmistakable what he's trying to say. But the really interesting thing there is that that happened right around the same time this morning when Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was trying, again, to calm the waters. He said, "I do not believe that there is any imminent threat from North Korea. Americans should sleep well at night," while the president is tweeting, that sort of escalation. So there is a discord here within the Trump administration as to how to message this.
Your news organization, Bloomberg, did an explainer on the steps that the president would have to take if he chose to retaliate with some kind of, nuclear missile strike. What, in a nutshell, what would that take?
Well, the important thing to know is that the president has sole authority to do this. The only verification that would happen once the president orders the launch of a nuclear strike would be that it has to be authenticated that the order did come from the president. Once that happens, nobody has the legal authority to block the president, to challenge him, or to countermand him. And depending on what specifically is being launched, this could happen from anywhere between 5 and 15 minutes. And in cases of ICBMs, they cannot be called back once they're fired. So this is obviously deadly serious stuff.
And any word on congressional response? I know a lot of Democrats had criticized the president. I think Senator John McCain on the Republican side critical of the statement. Any other reaction out there?
Well, a lot of Democrats have been critical of the statement. Talked about it as a thoughtless escalation and saber rattling that is not really backed by a strategy and does more harm than good. Republicans, for the most part, have been silent. Republican leaders, at least in the House and Senate, have not commented on this. A few of them who have done interviews back at home while they're in, while they're home for August recess, have commented on this, most notably, as you mentioned, Senator McCain, who says, you need to be more thoughtful and disciplined about this, and this has to be part of a larger overall strategy, which it's not quite clear at the moment. what the administration is thinking on that front.
We'll get more into U.S.-North Korea relations later on today on Central Time. Right now we're talking to Sahil Kapoor about the big stories in national news, national politics this week. Let's turn to the Senate reactions, some back and forth between Senator Mitch McConnell and President Trump's team. Senator McConnell gave some of his toughest criticism of some ways of President Trump this week. Here's what he said to a Kentucky Rotary Club about the president's expectations of Congress.
Now, our new president had, of course, not been in this line of work before, and I think had excessive expectations about how quickly things happen in the democratic process.
So not scathing words there, Sahil, but criticism from the Senate Majority Leader. Have we heard anything like this from Senator McConnell up till now?
It's certainly criticism. It was very carefully worded. You could almost see in that video clip Senator McConnell self-censoring a little bit to make sure he's getting his thoughts out without being, you know, without being overly critical. But I think what he's trying to say is he's trying to defend his leadership and the Senate, which has obviously not passed a major piece of legislation that, you know, you can consider a signature accomplishment for President Trump in his first 200 days in office. So I think Senator McConnell is trying to explain that expectations were set too high at the outset, and he sort of blamed the president for fueling those expectations. We've heard Senator McConnell very gently chide the president in the past for mostly for his use of Twitter. He says it's unhelpful, to the cause of staying on message. But this was a little bit, I think, a little bit escalated from that, because he did, you know, suggest that the president is, of course, a political novice and is still figuring, you know, still trying to learn the ropes. We did have just about an hour or two ago, President Trump responded himself on Twitter, and I'm just going to quote him here. He said, Senator Mitch McConnell said, I have, quote, excessive expectations, unquote, but I don't think so. After 7 years of hearing repeal and replace, why not done, unquote. That's a real, I mean, that's the president responding to the Senate Republican leader and you know, escalating this back and forth, which is highly unusual between these two.
And this comes as they're getting ready to work on a change to the tax system. This would be a big thing, a big agenda item for Republicans. Is there any sign that they're going to be able to come up with, President Trump and Majority Leader McConnell, Speaker Paul Ryan, a coordinated game plan on tax reform?
It's certainly the goal, and that's what they've been trying to do. You've had administration officials meeting with McConnell and Ryan, as well as the two top tax writers, one in the House, one in the Senate, pretty regularly for the last few months. And what they arrived at was this very broad statement of vague sort of principles that they want, you know, that they'll agree on. So everyone wants to lower rates on the individual and corporate side. Yes, every people want to reduce and eliminate loopholes, and they want to aim for a permanent tax revision. Now, that's the easy part. You know, that's the easy thing for Republicans to agree on. They're all pretty much on that page. But when it comes to fleshing out a detailed proposal that can, pass the House, that can pass the Senate, that can withstand what is sure to be fierce pushback from lobbyists and industry groups who are adversely harmed, which is, again, inevitable for any major tax rewrite, that is a tall order, and that remains to be seen. Now, they promised a pretty specific deliverable. Speaker Ryan, at the very least, has by the end of the year that there's going to be a major tax reform, a bill signed into law, and I think markets and businesses have reacted accordingly. They're expecting this to happen. So, you know, whether they can do it, it's far from clear they can, especially with all the chaos and I think all the dysfunction we've seen in Washington. But this is certainly the goal. I think this is going to be their number one priority for the rest of the year.
We're talking to Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, looking at the top political stories in our weekly look at national politics.
And you can weigh in by calling 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you agree with President Trump's response to North Korean threats? Are you concerned about the use of nuclear weapons? And what is your take on the White House response to the attack on a mosque in Minnesota? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
More coming up, including your calls, coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News. We're looking at the biggest national news stories of the week.
And you can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of President Trump's silence on the Minnesota mosque bombing this week? Do you agree with Mitch McConnell's criticism of the president for having unrealistic expectations of Congress? And should the president put more pressure on Congress to pass Republican legislation? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Sahil, getting back to the Senate for a moment, a Wisconsin story you have been following. Senator Ron Johnson made news with comments on Senator John McCain's vote on health care reform. What happened?
Yes, so I believe it was yesterday, sometime earlier this week, Senator Johnson was speaking on the radio about the health care vote that transpired, and Senator McCain, of course, was ended up being the deciding vote to shoot this bill down it was a stripped-down version of the ACA repeal that they called skinny repeal, and Senator Johnson, in that interview, seem to draw a link. I'm just going to quote him here because I don't want to mischaracterize. But he said, "I'm not going to speak for John McCain. He has a brain tumor right now. That vote occurred at 1:30 in the morning. Some of that might have factored in." Unquote. That was widely criticized immediately after it was reported as the senator drawing a link between Senator McCain's health condition, his brain tumor, and his decision to vote against the ACA repeal bill. The senator has since walked that back. Mr. Johnson put out a statement saying, I'm going to quote him again here, "I'm disappointed I didn't more eloquently express my sympathy for what Senator McCain is going through. I have nothing but respect for him, and the vote came at the end of a long day for everyone," unquote.
All right. Well, we'll see. That might be the end of that one. We'll watch for further comment. I want to bring in a caller. I think getting back to North Korea, we've got Susan on the line in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think really that we need to really rethink our policy. I think North Korea has a request behind all the saber rattling, and I think it's important for the powers that be to start thinking about how they can make a solution out of this as opposed to making it into a big possible nuclear war, which in we all know no one wins. And I'm disappointed that we don't have people that are supposed to be educated that can actually think about, well, how do we make this anger into a which is a request somehow. There's a request behind it. How do we make them a player at the table, making them feel like they, you know, deserve this place, and how do we make them really come to their senses in a calm manner instead of, all the saber rattling back and forth, which is clearly not good for anyone.
Susan, thanks for the call. We also heard from Charlie in Milwaukee, who couldn't stay on the line, who said he doesn't always agree, I think, with the president, but he appreciates the tougher, more confrontational approach. Maybe it's a new change that will work better with North Korea. And Sahil, that kind of spells out the problem in a nutshell. I think nobody knows exactly what's going to work with North Korea.
That's exactly right. This is a problem that has bedeviled the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the Obama administration. Everything that the smartest minds in the United States had tried with regard to North Korea has not worked. It is a very unique country in the sense that it's already pretty isolated, so economic sanctions don't have a huge impact. It spends most of its money on the military, and it has obviously nuclear capability. It has a leader who is, a little bit difficult to read. There are questions about how rational he is. So the idea of containing him and containing North Korea has continued to be a problem. I do think President Trump is attempting something that his predecessors have not, which is, to evoke the specter of a full-fledged war, in his words, like the world has never seen before. So I think that is a new tactic, which, to say the least, may not be any more successful than what his predecessors have tried.
Thanks for that call, Susan, and for calling in, Charlie. A couple more issues I want to get into in the news. Paul Manafort, former Trump campaign chair, office raided, the news came out. This was in late last month by the FBI. They visited him, a pre-dawn visit. Apparently he cooperated as they were looking for evidence. What does this tell us, Sahil, about the ongoing Russia 2016 campaign investigation?
A couple of things. It tells us it's certainly escalating between this news and the fact that Mueller is looking at convening a grand jury to explore, further escalations of this, suggests that this is absolutely moving forward. One of the interesting things about this is that the Washington Post reported that this, what they call the pre-dawn raid, happened late last month, which also suggests that Mueller is functioning not for the public eye. He's not leaking these things. He's operating, privately, the way an investigator generally should, and not trying to make waves, and not necessarily trying to make news out of this. So it seems like he's doing this in a methodical way. And I think the use of search warrants to apparently seize some documents and other things in the home suggests that there was a specific goal here. So. A rough stretch at this point for Paul Manafort.
And then closer to home here in the Midwest, a bomb exploded at a mosque in Bloomington, Minnesota, near the Twin Cities. What kind of responses have we seen from the Trump administration so far?
Not much. The president has not commented on that, on the bomb that exploded at the mosque in Bloomington. His national security aide, Sebastian Gorka, said it's only because they don't know the ideological motive behind the attack. But, of course, the president has not been shy to comment on prior attacks that were, that he's called terrorist attacks, that were eventually found later with more information to be terrorist attacks. I think this has also fueled criticism from I think his biggest skeptics, that the reason he's not commenting on this is because it was a mosque rather than a different site with a different group of victims. I think that's what his critics are raising the specter of.
And then briefly, as we wrap up, apparently some Republican donors may be holding back some of their money now after the failure of the Affordable Care Act repeal. What do we know about that?
Well, I think this is less of an issue in the House. I think this is certainly a problem that Republican Senate leaders have to face, which is that they promise their donors a bunch of things. Top of the list was ACA repeal. A lot of them would have gotten tax cuts, whether it is, reduction of things like the net investment income tax and things like that. And if you're not delivering what you're promising, then obviously donors are going to be skeptical as to whether you can do that in the future. So this is a normal thing. This is a byproduct of the fact that 200 days into the Trump administration, Republicans don't have a major achievement to brag about.
We'll leave it there for now. Sahil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us for our recap of the top stories in national news.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Patty C. first fell in love with baking as a child, and it's what still connects her with her mother.
Wake up, I whisper into my sister's sleepy face. Let's make blueberry muffins. Julie is home for the weekend, and I'm nestled between her and 14-year-old Geraldine early on a Saturday morning. As the youngest, I simply float from bedroom to bedroom, passed around like a spinster aunt. I won't get my own bed till I start kindergarten in the fall. After many tearful pleas for an easy bake, Mom finally said, "You really want to cook with a light bulb? Just use the real oven." Thus began my love of baking. Julie bakes with me whenever I want. She is 17 and living with our oldest sister 90 miles away. She's a kid herself, though it doesn't seem so in 1973, when teens smoked in front of their parents, went to bars, or to war. Julie left home to become a hippie, though no one knew it then. I wanted to be a baker. Instead, I became a writer. Many years later, I read that in her lifetime, Emily Dickinson was better known for her baked goods than her poetry. Mount Holyoke professor Christopher Benfee says, "In the kitchen, these secret spaces where she could be alone, that was really freedom. When Emily Dickinson bakes bread, there is something almost ecstatic about it, satisfaction of creativity." That's what I felt but could not yet convey at nearly 5 years old, stirring my batter as Julie looked on. Or as we peered inside the oven to see if our muffins were rising, and as we set them golden topped on the counter for the rest of our family to admire for a full second before they devoured every crumb. There's something primal about feeding the ones you love. Mom baked everything with love. A cliche, I know, but hold on. She and Dad raised 8 kids on a railroad worker's salary. Her inexpensive goodies weren't just sustenance, but carefully crafted for each of us. Joey loved angel food cake, David ice cream jello, Gerilyn chocolate cake, Julie and I blueberry muffins, Sharon, Jackie, Mary, I can't recall, but Mom knew. My earliest memories at Holy Ghost grade school aren't of the classroom, but walking home, a final turn into the alley that cut our block in half, through our hedge till the aroma of Mom's cookies pulled me across our backyard. As a mother myself, I recognize it wasn't what she made, but why and how. The first time I baked Emily Dickinson's gingerbread recipe was for my dad, just after Mom died. I consoled Dad with comfort food, baked treats, and homemade soups, and as I cooked some of Mom's recipes in my own tiny kitchen, I comforted myself. The first Christmas without Mom, I gave Dad an apron. On the front was a silkscreen photo of him and Mom on their 64th wedding anniversary. That day she was lost in an Alzheimer's haze, but still knew what to do when we brought out the camera, grasp her beloved's arm and smile wide. I made an apron for Julie, too, with a blown-up photo of one of Mom's letters to her, filled with family news just after Julie moved out. A handwritten recipe might have been more appropriate on an apron, but Mom rarely had to write hers down.
Patty C. is a writer in Lake Halley. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
First, the opioid crisis has reached such a critical level throughout the country that a recent task force urged President Trump to declare a state of emergency. When the president addressed the issue, he argued that the best course of action was to make sure that these drugs don't make it to the street.
Wisconsin has been among the states hit particularly hard by the epidemic. According to statistics from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, 614 people died in 2015 as a result of an opioid overdose. And the Milwaukee Medical Examiner's Office says that they've seen a 38% increase in deaths this year compared to this time last year.
Dr. Mike Miller is the medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, and he's with us now to talk about opioids, addiction, and the impact it has had on communities in Wisconsin. Dr. Miller, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's very nice for you to ask me back.
Well, we know that the opioid epidemic has been a nationwide issue, but could you focus now and paint a picture on what the problem has done, what it looks like here in Wisconsin?
Well, what it looks like here is that, we've frequently said that addiction is sort of an equal opportunity condition. There's a famous poster from years back with a picture of 30 different individuals of all ages, genders, colors, and it says this is the picture of an alcoholic. That's an old concept. But really, the opioid epidemic has hit every community in the nation. Large and small, rural probably even more than urban. Certainly it's not a non-white condition. It's a strongly, I would say that it fits the demographics of whatever community it's in. It's in Native American communities, it's in Hispanic American communities, it's in European American communities, it's in all communities. And the problem with this epidemic, the epidemic overall is not something you're going to stop at the borders, because the starting drug for so many people, now this may be changing a bit just very recently, but the starting drug for opioid addiction is prescription drugs, where it's manufactured in a pharmaceutical house in the United States. It originates with a legal prescription written for a patient by a doctor or nurse or dentist or someone who has prescribing authority. it's diverted, and it's used non-medically when people don't have pain, and it's used for euphoria or relief for someone who has addiction. And so interdiction at the borders isn't going to work because it starts with pharmaceuticals, and locking people up isn't going to really help. So you're not going to solve problems by incarceration, and the legal system knows that. It's going to have to be dealt with by treatment and prevention. So the thing that's different about this epidemic than the others is the lethality of the product from a single use, from the first use of your life. And again, that's not just because of that doesn't happen usually with pharmaceuticals. Usually people don't take a pill, even snorting it or even shooting it up in a dose to kill themselves with their very first use. That's not the usual thing. What people are dying of is the adulterants in heroin. Now, we could go into detail about how these adulterants, these fentanyl analogs like carfentanil and sufentanil, these various fentanyl cousins that are synthesized often overseas, actually can be brought in as a powder and put into a pill press and made to look like a tablet of almost anything. But in general, it's not appearing in something that people would buy on the street or from a, get it from a friend as a tablet that they think is a painkiller. It would be from a bag of something they thought was heroin. And it's laced with these products that are very, very potent and very, very lethal. So that's what's happening now, and this is why it's getting so much attention. The medical examiners, the coroners are seeing these deaths, the rates of deaths. I mean, it's just gotten to be ridiculous. And one of the reasons that the president's commission that he put together, chaired by Governor Christie, said that it should be declared a national emergency.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit and get at some of the news from yesterday. President Trump disagrees with you as some of what you said there. He is looking to stop opioids from coming over the border, and he says abstinence or prevention is the key. Here's a little bit of what he said.
The best way to prevent drug addiction and overdose is to prevent people from abusing drugs in the first place. If they don't start, they won't have a problem. If they do start, it's awfully tough to get off.
Now, there's the president's response. You said you disagree with that, Dr. Miller. Tell us why.
Yeah, I do. I do. And I was trying to finish. I was going to finish my sentence, and I just forgot where it was going because I was almost done. I know I spoke quite a bit, but the reason that the commission declared it a national emergency, and I think the reason they declared the opioid problem a national emergency is because it affects every community and because of the deaths. Now, getting on to the president, it was quite disappointing to me to hear the way he conceptualized this. He didn't even invite Governor Christie to meet with him and Secretary Price, and didn't include Governor Christie in the press conference held in Governor Christie's own state. It just seemed very odd that he convenes this group, this task force or this special group, and then doesn't even honor it enough to involve it in his discussions yesterday. And then at the press conference, the things he was saying almost weren't complete sentences, and they talked about concepts that are basically just say no, like Nancy Reagan and her husband said. And it just shows a profound ignorance of what addiction is and what needs to be done to address it. Just say no hasn't worked for anything, and you need to have a comprehensive approach of evidence-based prevention strategies. You need to have treatment available for opioid addiction. You need to have better treatment available for pain. If this problem was easy to fix, we would have fixed it several years ago. It's really complicated, and it's going to continue to require a multi-pronged approach in communities. And so many communities are doing things very constructively to address it. But the president's remarks didn't give me much confidence that there will be federal policy, at least coming from the White House, that will be truly effective to go forward.
Well, you said that the number of deaths that we've seen from the opioid epidemic might be reason enough to call the national emergency. What kinds of mechanisms would get swinging into action if a national emergency were to be declared?
Well, I believe you and me both know, and your listeners know, that if something is declared a national emergency and then other action doesn't follow, then who the heck bothers that it was declared anything? So the declaration is not the key issue. The key issue is to have multiple types of policies to try to address the issue, and one of them is better access to treatment. The other is better access to medications that block opioid receptors so people can't overdose. The other is better access to naloxone to reverse overdoses. Another actually is improved education of the general public and prescribers of the unique dangers of mixing sedative drugs like benzodiazepines with the Ativan, Valium, Xanax, things of those pharmaceuticals of those families with opioids, because that really does increase lethality, and we need to understand that better. But from a clinical perspective that I have, you certainly see that. And so it is complicated, but when people overdose, you need to revive them, and we need to have the Good Samaritan laws that we have passed in this state, saying that if someone calls in 911 and an overdose, that first responders come and the police are not right there to arrest people for possession charges. We need to not have legal issues that dissuade people from calling 911 when there's a medical emergency. So we need to have the person survive to truly live another day, hopefully get into counseling, get the help they need, get the medications they need. So overdose reversal is important. Having medication treatment, and the medications are naltrexone, which blocks the opioid receptor purely, or methadone and buprenorphine, which block it in different ways than a pure antagonist. But having people on medication that will reduce the chance of them actually having coma or death if they do use opioids, that's important too. Addiction treatment availability in the private sector and the public sector, all these things are really important. And one of the most important things, and I talked about this the last time I was on your program, was we need to make sure that we preserve the Affordable Care Act and the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, one signed by President Obama, the previous one by President George W. Bush, to make sure that we have private sector insurance vehicles and Medicaid to pay for addiction treatment, and we don't have some of the things coming out of the current Congress of repeal and replace, which would throw tens of millions of people off of insurance and reduce their access to necessary addiction treatment.
And we're talking to Dr. Mike Miller right now about the opioid crisis in Wisconsin and also the rest of the country. He's the medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what you're hearing from President Trump on the opioid crisis? Have you, your friends, your family been affected by this opioid crisis? What is happening in your part of the state? Are you hoping to see more access to treatment or more of a criminal justice approach, a tough-on-crime approach? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue our conversation in a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about the opioid crisis and also the government's response to addressing that issue with Dr. Mike Miller. He's the medical director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be done to turn the tide on the opioid epidemic in the United States and here in Wisconsin? How has it impacted your community? Is this a story for you, for your friends and family? If you work in public health or similar fields, how would you like to see the opioid crisis dealt with? And what are you seeing in your clinic or as a first responder? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Dr. Miller, rural Wisconsin, as you said, has been hit especially hard here in Wisconsin by the opioid crisis. What is happening in rural Wisconsin that makes it particularly vulnerable to this?
Well, that's a very challenging question that has to do with anthropology and economics, and some people think it has to do with just opportunities, economic opportunities. People use substances sometimes because they want reward, but sometimes because they're looking for emotional relief. And it's been known for a good while, this before the opiate epidemic, just let's say during the cocaine epidemic of the 80s. Of course, marijuana has been around in the majority culture strongly for over 50 years now, one is more likely to have a drug addiction diagnosis in a city of 3,000 or under than a city of 200,000 or greater. That came out of the Center for Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University in a study a number of years ago on rural addiction. There's all sorts of hypotheses that sociologists have about there's not opportunities for recreation. So many kids get into alcohol at young ages in rural communities. There's nothing to do but go to the bar or go drink at the gravel pit or what have you. It's actually really complicated. I'm not going to pretend that I really know the answer to this, but you've certainly heard a lot of people talk about some sort of correlations between, the Rust Belt and loss of manufacturing jobs, economic despair, and you've heard these things about, you know, did this propel President Trump into the White House and all sorts of things, but there seem to be some possible demographic overlaps between rural poverty, rural low economic opportunity, heavier substance use, opioids, and death. The epicenter of opioid epidemic, even when it began as a pill problem, was Appalachia, was Western Virginia, Southwestern Virginia, the state of West Virginia, Southeastern Kentucky. Still, nobody has outpaced those areas, even bleeding into southeastern Ohio, as being the heaviest rates. Charleston, West Virginia, the state capital, has the highest rates of death. I mean, it's just tragic. But I think I should stop and leave this to the anthropologists and the sociologists to figure out some of this. You asked earlier in one of your things about, you know, asking listeners to call in. What is your opinion about a criminal justice approach? And really, if you ask judges, prosecutors, police, jailers, is locking them up the solution? They will tell you, please no. We need a broad public health approach to this. And some of the talk we heard out of the president yesterday is very ancient thinking. And it's not that helpful, and that's why it was so disappointing. I would have hoped that he would have been better briefed, better aware of what the challenges we face are. I think Governor Christie has a much better idea than what the president at least showed in his remarks yesterday at his press conference yesterday afternoon.
Let's get our callers in on this. We've got Don with us first in northern Wisconsin. Don, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was written a prescription for MS Contin every day for every month for almost 19 years for chronic pain. And December 1st of last year, I was just pulled off of them with no help whatsoever, no phone number to call for support, nothing. And I... it's just broken me. I have a lot of lasting effects from floundering for 2.5 months like that, because I didn't have anyone to call even about my withdrawals. I just kind of got see ya, wouldn't want to be ya from the doctors.
Don, thank you so much for calling, and I can hear in your voice how it's affected you. And is this the flip side, Dr. Miller, that some people who have had this prescription, now that there may be some consciousness, some awareness that the prescriptions can be a gateway to opioid abuse and that's being dialed back, are people sometimes who, depending on these prescriptions, are they suffering like Don?
Many are, and what happened to your caller should not have happened. It's not the way to go. We have no idea if your caller has addiction. We have no idea. We know that she was exposed to opioids for chronic pain for years and developed a significant physical dependence, and her brain changed, and she may be having all sorts of aspects of withdrawal, including a lot of emotional withdrawal because of what it does to dopamine systems in the brain. The approaches for how to keep another generation of developing addiction to prescription pain pills are not the same as the approaches to dealing with all the people who are on high-dose opiates now as a result of some of the misguided education to physicians over the last two-plus decades. And doctors who prescribed to this woman, your caller, were doing what they were taught to do in education courses. And they were doing what even the licensing board said was the appropriate thing to do. And now the licensing boards have different views, and the education is changing, and we realize there was a lot of misinformation that was put out there. And we need to not use the clinical approaches for chronic pain and to opioid prescribing that were used at the beginning of this century, beginning in the last few years of the 1990s. So we need to change the way we deal with chronic pain, but that's not helping this woman. And she needed to have her dosage adjusted, tapered, possibly even maintained. And to cut her off abruptly was not good medical practice and not humane. So I'm concerned, but yes, this is what can happen. And just broadly, physicians are not as well educated as they need to be. I hope your doctors would know everything.
Excuse me, Dr. Miller. We've got a lot of interference on your phone line there, so I'm going to go to a caller and see if that clears up here. Melissa is next with us in Green Bay. Melissa, hi.
Hi. Hi. I am so happy to be talking to you, and I am so sorry to the last caller. I had not a terrific experience in recovery, but I am in recovery. I've got 30 days clean. And,
congratulations.
I went to Brown Deer, Rogers and Brown Deer, and detoxed. And while there, I was put on Suboxone. And without the Suboxone and my meetings working the steps and my IOP classes, I don't know that I could have stayed clean for the last 30 days.
Melissa, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
No, thank you so much for calling and for sharing your experiences, and thanks to Don. And appreciate everyone's calls. If you'd like to continue the conversation, please keep it going over on the Central Time Facebook page. And Dr. Miller, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, I was very, very glad to have the opportunity, and you have a wonderful program, and thanks to your listeners as well.
All right, thanks so much. Dr. Mike Miller, Medical Director of the Harrington Recovery Center at Rogers Memorial Hospital in Oconomowoc, and he joined us today to talk about the president's call to address the opioid crisis in states across the country, and taking a look there also at how opioids have affected Wisconsin, looking at different approaches the president has opted not to declare a state of emergency when it comes to opioids, looking at addressing it through different avenues. And again, we love hearing your experiences. If this is something that's touched your life, has touched the life of a friend or a family member, tell us what you think and what do you think about the president's response. You can let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're always on the lookout for unique and interesting foods here on Central Time, whether we'd actually want to eat them or not. And a hip, happening pop-up restaurant in New York City is taking us into uncharted territory next week with Cheetos.
Cheetos, that's right. The Spotted Cheetah. It's going to be called Owned and Operated by the Makers of Cheetos, bring celebrity chef Anne Burrell on board to create kind of fancy cuisine. It's going to be built around that featured ingredient, Cheetos.
So looking at the proposed menu, recipes include Flamin' Hot and white cheddar mac and Cheetos.
Wait,
Mac and Cheetos. Cheetos crusted fried pickles and creamy ranch, and Cheetos Sweetos crusted cheesecake. I had to look that up. Sweetos apparently are, I had not encountered this, a sweet dessert version of Cheetos.
Right, I managed to miss that too, and I have in my life consumed Cheetos before. I prefer the crunchy over the puffy ones. My family all likes the puffy, which makes road trips kind of a drag sometimes. But back to this restaurant, Rob, would you go?
No, I'm old-fashioned. I like my snack treats as nature intended them. I guess there's nothing natural going on. You know, I like to
neon
eat them,
orange,
maybe dip them in one thing, like maybe ranch. Cheetos don't even dip in stuff, though.
I would eat, okay, so of this list, I would eat the Cheetos crusted fried pickles. At least I'd try one. That sounds okay.
I guess if I were there and I had to, I would try one. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.